This is Jerry Pippen. We're dealing with the Kennedy assassination. It'll be 30 years on Monday. Boy, it doesn't seem like it's been that long. We have Jim Moore, who has a book out called Conspiracy of One, the definitive book on the Kennedy assassination. The second printing of the paperback, it's from the Summit Group, is out and available at your bookstore. If it's not there, they can order it for you right away. And, Jim, why don't we just go to the phones? We got a lot of callers, and kind of do it that way.
Oh, that'll be great, Jerry. Please please keep in mind that I've been doing show after show, and I'm a little punch drunk, so if I don't sound as coherent as I usually do, why, that's why.
Well, that's fine. You're sounding good. In fact, a couple of places that you were on earlier, you're on again. So,
okay.
With us. Hey, George, listening to us in Lantana, Florida, how are you?
Right, fine. I'd like to bring up a couple points for Jim. One that seems to strengthen his view, and that is that Bill Moyers stated in an interview on PBS about a year ago that he actually was the person who turned the motorcade onto Houston and to Elm Street because there was a large crowd there, and he felt that it's as simple as and as innocent as that. He felt that they would get a better view of the president. So if that's the case, then that kind of strengthens Mr. Moore's point. However, the other side of the coin is that if the slivers found in Governor Connolly turned out to be from another gun, that would indicate a second gun theory, if those bullets turned out to be not from the magic bullet.
It's too late. Governor Connolly's already buried, so I guess we'll never know.
Well, they wanted to examine that, and the family clamped down on that, and they said absolutely not. Now, that also brings up an interesting point. Why was that not?
Well, let's ask Jim. Jim, you know, there's a book out called The Texas Connection. By Craig Zirbel out in Phoenix, and he pretty well lays at the feet of Lyndon Johnson.
Well, I call Craig's book I call Craig Mr. Speculation, so you know I don't have a tremendous affection for.
Well, I mean,
book.
But other people have said
sure,
as much, and here this listener saying Bill Moyers turned the. And I respect Bill Moyers a lot. I don't think he'd be involved in a murder.
No, I think it was innocent. I mean, I think he just, at the last moment, as a good press secretary, said he'd get better coverage by taking him into to more of a situation where more people could see the president. I think it was as innocent as that.
Okay, so, George, thanks a lot. Listening, Jim's going to comment now.
Here's the interesting point of the story, George. Moyers was not in Dallas until after the assassination. He flew in while Lyndon Johnson was sitting on the tarmac waiting to be sworn in by Sarah Hughes. So he couldn't have made that decision in any case, and I don't know the context in which he said that, but it wasn't his decision to make. The turn was prescribed really by the Dallas traffic patterns, and anybody who's spent a great deal of time in Dallas would have recognized it was literally the only way for the motorcade to go. Jim Garrison, of course, who perpetrated this whole fiction that the motorcade made a turn to put it in front of the book depository, was grossly in error and had never spent a great deal of time studying the city's traffic patterns. The fragments in the governor, which were quite properly, I think, buried with him, you're correct. The family, Jerry, did not allow those fragments to be removed, and there was a reason why, and that reason is quite simply that they would not have solved anything. If, in fact, we'd gotten them out and we found that they came, for example, from the base of Commission Exhibit 399, 5 years from now you'd see books propounding that the fragments were switched, or the exhumation was a fake, or it would go on and on. So there was no useful purpose to be served by mutilating the governor's body, and I think the family recognized that.
Okay, thank you, George. Here's on the line now from Phoenix, listening to us on KFYI AM 910 News Radio, is a young man by the name of Craig, and Craig called in earlier tonight, Jim, and he's been doing his own investigation through the Freedom of Information Act, and I think he wants to take you on a couple of issues.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, either. I'm just kind of interested in this because of seeing the effect it had on my family and that, and I don't really subscribe to any one conspiracy theory. I'm not biased, let me tell you that. But let's start with the murder weapon. I think that is critical to any investigation into this matter. Why don't the riflemen, the serial numbers match up? Why doesn't the rifle introduced into evidence match up the rifle serial number and model that was sold to Oswald.
You're referring, I assume, to the length discrepancy in the Klein's ad, am I correct?
Yes, I am.
Well, the difficulty is twofold. First of all, some of the Carcanos that Klein's imported from Riva, who remanufactured them in essence for export to America, were of the earlier 38 Cavalry edition, which is the length of the weapon described in the ad. The longer weapon, of which I have four, for example, one of which was made 1,000 rifles before Oswald's in the same arsenal, is the more popular of the two, but I suspect that somebody at Klein's didn't understand that there was a differentiation and listed the wrong length. However, the weapon described in the photograph that accompanies the ad is the weapon that is identical to the one found on the sixth floor. So. Certainly, I guess you can make a case for one weapon being ordered and another being received. It seems to me in this case that it was a pretty sloppy copywriter error.
Okay, now that's an interesting explanation, but the serial numbers don't match up.
Well,
granted, the National Firearms Act didn't come in until 68.
Right.
Okay, but shopkeepers, like at Klein's, generally kept a record when they would ship things, mail order, of the serial numbers.
I don't know where you say they don't match up, and let me give you my reason for saying that. I know that I have seen the physical import list from Riva to Klein's. I know that I have seen the same serial number entered on the Klein's bill of sale to the post office box in Dallas, and that same serial number appears on the weapon taken into possession by the DOJ. So,
yeah, Craig, where did you get that?
I got that from my independent research. And I have not had contact with Klein's yet, but I will.
Your independent research, you mean somebody in the government mailed you something, or the
yes.
Warren?
Yes.
I have some
people that are some former intelligence people that I've checked out that are giving me some information. Now, whether it's bogus, I don't know, but I'm open to find out the truth here. I think that's what we're attempting to do.
Well, you know, the other interesting point about the serial number, Craig, was raised by Sylvia Marr back in 66 or 67. She maintained that there might have been any number of C-2766 weapons floating around, and that is not correct. There would have been, for example, a UC-2766, but there's no other C-2766 to be found. And if you go back and you study the different plants that were producing weapons for the Italian government, particularly in the late 30s, you come across, say, the Beretta concern and the factory at Tierney. Those plants did not produce weapons with the same serial numbers. So I think that's kind of a specter as well. I'd obviously be very interested in following up on the information that you're getting.
Okay, well, that I can leave my address for you, and I'll be more than happy.
Well, what we'll do, Craig, is at the end of the hour, I'll give my mailing address. You just mail me the stuff, and I'll send it to Jim.
Okay, the other issue, Marina Oswald's parents, namely her father, KGB, all the way.
Well, it was actually her uncle.
I'm sorry, her uncle.
Yeah,
I don't have my notes in front of me.
No, who was by and large, a colonel in Soviet intelligence. I don't subscribe anything to that, Craig, of sinister import for this reason. If, in fact, the KGB files that we are seeing today are accurate and they thought Oswald some sort of a joke, then you have to assume that this guy was, A, not particularly swift when it came to doing his job, or B, didn't consider Oswald much of a threat or an intelligence opportunity. It seems to me that Marina is what she's always been, and the fact that her uncle was KGB doesn't really change a great deal.
Yeah. Now, Craig and Jim, both, if I think I'm right about this. I've read so many of these books, you know, I get a little screwed up, Jim. But I think Marina was very, very afraid of being deported at one time.
She was after the assassination, and she maintains today that fear made her say a great many things that weren't necessarily true about her husband. The problem with Marina is that not only has her story wiggled and waffled over the years because she's been questioned, I think, by so many people, and she's become kind of the flavor of the month, but the difficulty, too, is that she told Priscilla McMillan Johnson,
the lady that wrote the book about her.
Right, Marina and Lee, a pretty complete account of what had gone on, and she told the House Select Committee some years later that anything she told Priscilla was gospel truth. Well, unfortunately, the things that she told Priscilla strongly incriminate Lee Oswald. They don't bear any relation to what she's saying today, And if, in fact, she was telling the truth 20 years ago, I think you have to go to the bank with what's in that book.
Well, let me ask you about that. She told Priscilla, if I remember, that she took the picture of Lee Harvey Oswald with the weapons out in her backyard. And some of these conspiracy books say, hey, that's a different head or a different body or whatever because of the shadows. We're not going to get into that. But there were, you know, Marina only said she took one picture, and there are at least two, maybe three pictures of that floating around, I think.
Well, at first she remembered only taking one. Later she remembered taking two. As you say, the weight of evidence indicates she took three. But in addition to telling Priscilla that she had taken the picture, she also told her mother-in-law, who was Lee Harvey's staunchest defender. And it is in her mother-in-law's Warren Commission testimony that one finds corroboration for Marina's earlier account. Marguerite did not have anything to gain by saying that Marina had taken these pictures. Quite the contrary, it would have been exculpatory of her son to say that someone else had taken them. But her Warren Commission testimony is very explicit to the point that her daughter-in-law told her, "Mama, I took," and actually helped to destroy one of the photographs before the police confiscated them.
Okay, another issue.
I've got to take a break. Craig, hold on.
All right.
Going to give you another shot at it, and then we need to go as fast as we can. We've got a lot of other callers here. And Jim's been up all day and night doing these shows, so he can't stay past the next hour. He'll be talking in his sleep. So we'll try to get it all in. Hold on, Jim. 1-800-745-8255. We have one line open. We'll try to get all the questions in. I am upset with my cable company, and I have a hunch I'm not the only guy. I've got good news for you if you're upset with your cable company, or maybe you're like Jim and you live out in a little out someplace and you don't have cable because it's not available. I found a place